Get your daily market recap on the latest stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcasts.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrow and Lisa Abramowitz. Join us each day for insight from the best in economics, geopolitics, finance, and investment. Subscribe to Bloomberg Surveillance On Demand on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere you get your podcasts. And always on Bloomberg.com, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App. Joining us now is really one of the key calls within the Bloomberg surveillance world. It's rarely that you get somebody to give you a statistic or directional call and also throw a date on it. Matthew Lozzetti and the team led by Peter Hooper and David Folkerts-Landau at Deutsche Bank had the courage to do that a long, long time ago. They said there is going to be a slowdown, some form of NBER recession, but it's going to be out there. He nailed that call. We get an update this morning with Mr. Lozzetti. Okay, let's go to the timed element now. Which week, which day, which hour do we get a recession?
Yeah, you know, the timing is always very difficult.
I'll let you go to a month. Well, give me the month.
We're still Q4. We updated our outlook this week, kept the recession timing in Q4. You know, I think it's based on we've seen the Fed tighten, obviously, very aggressively. You've seen credit conditions tighten. You've seen some breadcrumbs within the labor market data of some softening. I'd be cautious about this morning's data just because there's a lot of volatility. There's seasonal adjustment issues. There's states that are they're moving around. But if you look at the last Friday's jobs report, it showed the permanent job losers really rising. And that's, I think, an important indicator. And then as you look forward for the consumer, you have excess savings dissipating by the end of the year. You have student debt payments coming back. And so we think it's a consumer that looks a lot weaker by the end of this year.
What gives you confidence, especially since people have been pushing out this date again and again and again?
Yeah, I don't think you want to express too much confidence on any particular month or quarter, to be honest. You know, the labor market has proven to be more resilient. The consumer has proven to be more resilient. But I think, unfortunately, for the Fed, so has inflation. And that was kind of our expectation as you go back to last year. It was that the labor market was strong. It was that the consumer was strong. And then, therefore, inflation was going to be more persistent and the Fed would have to move more aggressively. I think looking ahead, I think the Fed skips next week, barring a big upside surprise to CPI. But I also think that they tee up a rate hike over the next several meetings. We think that comes in July.
If they skip, if they go through with that kind of shift, do you expect a meaningful move up in longer-term yields? Or basically, people say, maybe this is a sign that this Federal Reserve is willing to accept inflation that is a two-point-something over the longer term.
Yeah, I think that's the worry from their perspective, that you get this upward shift in inflation expectations because the market interprets it as they are losing some of their credibility or commitment to that 2% objective. And so I think they will want to do anything to push back or kind of tone that down that notion. I think even from the doves you've heard, you know, they want to skip, but they want to be very clear that this is not the peak of the tightening cycle, that there's very likely the potential for more rate hikes to come.
We've given short shrift this week to the crew, including Ed Hyman at Evercore ISI, who say, look, we're going to disinflate. With clarity in your note, and again, you've got the courage to put a date on it, year-end 2024, December of 2024, some kind of sub-3% inflation. How does our world change with, say, 2.65% inflation?
I think it's all about how you get to there. We, for our forecast at the end of next year, are down at 2.25% core PCE. So it looks like the Fed
is very close to there. No one's mentally pricing that in right now.
Well, I think it depends on how you get there. Now, if it's an immaculate disinflation where the labor market stays where it is, then that's kind of a fantastic outcome for the economy, for markets. If it's a recession that is needed to get you there, that it's a labor market that very much needs to weaken, I think it's a very different dynamic. the Fed, you know, I think their own forecasts have shown a need for some recession and rising unemployment. It's clear that the staff over the past several meetings have come to that conclusion as well. You know, we still hold that view, that they really do need this economy to slow materially, the labor market to weaken, to get close to 2%.
And the legacy of Deutsche Bank analysis, this even goes back to Adam Siminski and oil years ago, is always think dynamics. So I've got wage growth coming down, but I've got inflation screaming down to 2.x%. Can we have a quote-unquote Lazzetti recession with actual real wage stability or real wage growth?
I think what you will see is that wages will come down materially as the labor market weakens. And that is, I think, part of the Fed's game plan. They talk about, you know, wages being a very important input into that X service, core services, X shelter component. We think it's an important, the overall labor market is an important input into rental inflation. So to get back to 2% sustainably, I think you need a softer labor market, and the Fed needs wage growth to come down closer to that metric that Chair Powell cites of 3%.
Do you think that if they go again in July, assuming they skip next week, that the Fed is done after that?
I think there's still upside risks. You know, I think everybody has been consistently surprised, and those surprises have all been in one direction, which is inflation stickier, labor market stronger, consumer a bit more resilient than anticipated. And so you don't want to discount the kind of serial correlation in those surprises. Could we get more? I think it's certainly possible, which could push the Fed to raise rates.
Raise rates beyond. Again. Yeah, again, yeah. Beyond 5.5%. I'm just wondering, though, from your perspective, as we head into this mid-year point and everybody writes their mid-year outlooks, whether there's anything that you're kind of changing, shifting, second-guessing from the first half that you think will be a driving theme heading into the next 6 months.
Yeah, for us, it's definitely the potential that this cycle takes a little bit longer to play out and that therefore the recession doesn't come by the end of this year, but a little bit later. I think for us, the key has been that we've pushed back the timing of rate cuts. We're now in March of next year, in part because the unemployment rate takes a bit longer to get there. I think just one important counterfactual here is that if we had not had these banking stresses emerge, it looked likely that the Fed was going to raise rates by 50 basis points in March. And having done that, I think they probably would have done so in May. And so the counterfactual is we'd probably be 50 basis points higher on the Fed funds rate. Right. The key question for them is, are credit conditions tightening enough to offset that?
What's the counterfactual of China? Do they export disinflation, even outright deflation? What do they do? The struggles they seem to be having, how does that change the American model?
Yeah, certainly the global growth impulse that people are expecting from China is seemingly not there as much as anticipated. I think the real concern from an inflation perspective in the U.S., however, has been that not only is services elevated, we've seen core goods inflation over the past 3 or 4 months also bounce back. Now, last month was all about used cars, so you want to discount that a little bit. But go back 3 or 4 months before that, it was broad-based. It was household furnishings. Right. It was medical goods. And so there's, even in that category that we have the most confidence that you're going to get this big disinflationary impulse.
Tell me you're not walking back to the office. You're not
actually.
Come on. It's like deadly out there.
Do you have a mask?
And I do have a mask.
Yes.
You guys have some down in the lobby.
Yes.
So I'll grab one.
Taking one of Mike's last masks.
So I brought one for myself.
So I'm going to go out there and die today.
I'll leave one for you.
Matt Lazzetti walking across Central Park. Matt, what do you call the building?
The Deutsche Bank Center.
The Time Warner
Center.
CNN
Deutsche Bank Center.
Just the Deutsche Bank Center.
Very exciting. Well, we'll do something over there sometime here. Mr. Lazzetti is with Deutsche Bank. But right now, and this is really important, on radio and television, if you want to know at the margin where to allocate next, listen carefully to Kristen Bitterly, head of North America Investments at Citi Global Wealth. We're thrilled she could join us today. There's a buried sentence in the usual blather of a mid-year outlook that you released today, which is, are you playing defense or are you being on the sidelines? That is a perfect metaphor for the emotion right now.
I think that's exactly right. There's this feeling out there that you're either all in or all out of the market. That I think you guys were talking about this earlier on the program, this idea that you're either all in T-bills and sitting in that 5%, or somehow you're chasing and finding a defensive play in tech stocks. And so what we've done, and this is something that we've done from the very beginning of the year, is we've actually been very balanced in terms of our fixed income portfolios, our equity portfolios, where we are fully invested, but we're picking our spots in those asset classes in terms of quality. And when you look at the performance of something like that year to date, it's actually high single-digit returns for a balanced portfolio. It's not the 25% of the NASDAQ, but it's certainly strong returns year to date.
Stan Druckenmiller was great yesterday with Shanali Basak. He talked about the prospect of going into recession and compared almost staples to what's happening with AI and NVIDIA. Can I compare, can I put in the same bucket some of these tech names with consumer staples?
I would love to hear that in more detail. I think that would be a challenging analysis to do. But I think when we talk about what's happened within the market more broadly, I do think this concentration, and everyone's talking about this, this is not a new story about the breadth in the market. The breadth in the market, those seven stocks representing more than 100% of the gains. Even if you look, it's not a uniquely U.S. story. That's a global story as well, that there's 10 companies representing 85% of the global gains. And so what does that tell me? It actually tells me that the market is pretty rational. Where the money has been going into has been these mega cap companies with strong free cash flow generation, the ability to fund growth, not dependent on credit markets, have their balance sheets in order, and a lot of them have raised guidance going forward.
So given that, right, given that maybe there's rationality, but maybe you don't want to play that because you can't really predict the AI future, are you starting to now say that the rational plays of, say, regional banks, of, say, just generally financials, areas that have gotten beaten up, are looking good again if things aren't that bad?
That's one of the themes in our outlook, is actually this coming rotation within equities. So as I mentioned earlier, we have been playing defense. We've been invested in areas like global dividend growers, but some of the areas that we've been eyeing and adding exposure. So something like mid-cap, right? So looking at mid-cap and the valuation differential, trading at about a 28% discount to larger cap. Looking at some of those themes, you have to be selective. This isn't just kind of a broad brush. You want profitable companies just like you want profitable companies in large cap. But that's an area when people ask the question, has this theme gotten away from me? You can actually find opportunities just going down the cap structure.
One thing we've been talking about throughout the morning is the weight of people who have been hiding in T-bills to go into NVIDIA, to go into big tech, to look for those double-digit returns that you were talking about and not be happy with single-digit returns, even if they look pretty good on a risk-adjusted level. You've been traveling a lot, talking with clients. What do they say? How much pressure are you hearing to get a little bit more with respect to earnings?
I think everyone is asking that question of, is tech a buy? Should I continue to chase this rally? And I think one of the most interesting things, bringing it back to the AI conversation, because we have to, right? That's just the dominant conversation right now. I think there are fabulous companies out there, but they're valued at, you know, an even more extreme level. And so in terms of making money in any type of market, it's really that differential. And so some of the areas that, if you think of the net beneficiaries of AI, the concentration has really been in those mega cap companies. But then when you look at areas like cybersecurity, that's going to have to come along for the ride. Areas like one of our long-term unstoppable trends is investing in longevity, a net beneficiary of this technology, where you haven't seen that type of valuation and you haven't seen the funds really come into those areas. Those are ways to be invested, but not in a pure play.
Just quickly, what's special about 4,300 on the S&P?
I don't think anything's special about 4,300.
What is it about getting into 4,299 this week and just stopping there and pulling back?
I think the major conversation is once we hit that 20% appreciation level and this idea that all of a sudden it would turn into a true bull market. I think we have to look at whether you're in the camp of higher for longer in interest rates or you're in the camp that we could see a cut at the end of this year. If there is some type of recession ultimately and some type of, it has to signal that we're going to see further contraction within earnings. And that's something that I think the outlook right now is a little bit too rosy. We actually, that was one thing coming into this year, we thought we were going to see about a 10% contraction in earnings. We've reduced that. We think it's about going to be about a 6% based on the strong Q1, but still a contraction.
This conversation is of 15 years ago. I'm not used to a normal conversation that was in Fibosi or in, you know, the CFA curricula. I mean, it's shocking to hear this. It's like, oh, a normal conversation after 15 years of oddity. We're all recalibrating.
15 years of zero rates, is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, and there was no risk-free rate. The Sharpe ratio didn't work. I mean, it's all there is to it, and we all made it up as we went. And what's so important here, John, is all the focus of the media, the financial press, is on short covering, a short squeeze, convexity to the upside, stuff I don't even understand. And you know what it's about? The Bitterly world, the David Kelly world, which is the basic idea, do you have the courage to get off the sidelines? That's the heart of the matter.
The cash trap.
Yeah.
It's been a feature of the show. for the last few weeks. Kristen, thank you.
Thank you.
Kristen Biddley, the Citi Global Wealth Management.
Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Join host Keith Lansford for this information-packed daily market recap, delivered in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcast. That's schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Ed Yardeni joining us now, the president of Yardeni Research. Ed, I've loved the notes over the last couple of weeks. The mother of all melt-ups. Ed, are we closer to a melt-up than a melt-down?
Well, I think we've definitely had a melt up in the mega cap 8 stocks, as you've been highlighting. These stocks have kind of taken over the market in recent weeks. I think it really started with the banking crisis, right? In March 8th or so, when we started having the banking crisis, the financials took a dive. Even energy took a dive on fears that if the financials are going down, that can't be good for the economy. And the energy stocks went down. But people still wanted to be in the market, and they ran into the mega cap 8 because they have cash, they have cash flow, and they have good business. I think the market's actually going to broaden out back to the financials. Right now, we've got some uncertainty, concerns about whether there might be another rate hike. But I think the economic outlook is still pretty good. And I think once people get more comfortable with the financials, I think the market will broaden out in that direction.
Ed, I want to give a look back here quickly in a victory lap for you. You've had a set of victory laps over a lengthy career. In October, Ralph Ancampora and Edward Yardeni said, climb on board this bottom in the market. You're up 19% from your October low. Right. The triple leveraged Yardeni fund, this is something in develop right now, is a 57% at return since October.
Okay,
yeah, that's before Yardeni takes out his 2 and 20. But the answer here, Yardeni, I want you to talk to people who missed it. They didn't listen to Ralph Ancampora. They didn't listen to Ben Laidler. They didn't listen to Ed Yardeni. Talk to the people who miss this rally, how they get on board.
Well, I'm still optimistic that the market is going to move higher by the end of the year into next year. I think next year is sort of the environment that the market is increasingly thinking about discounting. And I think the economy is going to be better. I think earnings are going to be better. However, we have had a heck of a move, and it's been in these large cap stocks. I think, as I said, look for where there's been laggards, and there certainly have been laggards in the financial. There have been laggards in energy, even in industrials. In addition to the melt-up scenario, I've for mega caps. I've also been monitoring the situation for construction in the United States, and it's absolutely booming for non-residential construction, and I think it's about to boom for infrastructure spending. And so I think the industrials are another place to be.
You were saying that the 4,600 target that you currently have might be conservative if this all bears out. What do you say to those who push back and say, if that comes to pass and all of the people who are in cash decide it is the time to throw in the towel and go into equities, that will give the Fed more ammunition to hike rates further and kill this off more quickly?
Well, I think the Federal Reserve officials have been saying for quite some time that they want to get the interest rate, the Fed funds rate, up to a restrictive level. I think 5.25% is proving to be restrictive. There has been a banking crisis. We have seen surveys of loan officers saying that they are tightening lending standards. So I think they're where they wanted to be. And I think they have to factor in that quantitative tightening, as well as the tightening of lending standards, probably amounts to at least another 50, 100 basis points in effective federal funds rate hikes. So if the funds rate now is 5.25%, I think effectively it's already at 6.25%.
But if that's not enough, Ed, to slow any kind of growth, and you are seeing construction construction companies actually seeing a boom, you're seeing the housing market reignite, you're seeing all shoots of possibly some sort of recovery in manufacturing sectors that have been beaten up. Doesn't this go against the idea that it is enough, that it is restrictive enough to bring about a decline in inflation to the degree that the Fed would like?
Well, inflation has been coming down, as you know. Maybe it's not coming down as rapidly as some people think, but I think it's proven to be quite transitory in durable goods and even non-durable goods, where we still have stickiness or persistence is in services. And we know that rent inflation in the real world has come down pretty dramatically, and that's likely to mean that we get down to something like 3-4% inflation by the end of this year. Right now, we're about 4-5%. So I'm optimistic that inflation can very well can come down very well on its own without any more restriction. I think a lot of the inflation was pandemic related. It was a shock. There have been aftershocks. And I think we're sort of normalizing.
And Giordani, you talk about a broadening market. Help me with packaged goods. Some of them are trading at 19, 20, 21 times earnings. Am I supposed to acquire new shares in those companies? I mean, I'm just dazzled by the idea of buying new shares at a 21 multiple that's got a low single digit revenue growth.
You know, the bears have been certainly right about the fact that we have really never seen a situation where a bull market got started with multiples basically at fair value. The forward PE of the S&P 500 was 15.1. on October 12th, when the market bottomed. And that is troubling to a lot of people. But the reality is, if you take out the mega cap eight, which are unusual stocks, you get a multiple of about 16. So again, it's closer to fair value. Whereas with them, you're at 18, 18 and a half. So I think you have to really kind of slice and dice the stock market and look for where the value is right now. And as I said, it's beaten up financials that seem to be pretty good values. Industrials, I don't think, have discounted what we're seeing with onshoring and with building chip plants in the United States, electric vehicle battery plants, and so on. So I think there are still opportunities in the market.
Great to catch up, Ed. What a call. Just to be constructive so far through this year. Remains constructive. Ed Giordani of Giordani Research, talking up the financials.
Continue on now, and we do so with Jeffrey Yu visiting with Paul Sweeney yesterday at his BNY Mellon conference in Florida, and has jetted up to join us. He is senior market strategist, BNY Mellon. It's a quiet period, but it's not a quiet period. I'm going to ask you an open question to start. Equities, bonds, currencies, commodities, where is your single focus now into the Fed meeting?
I think the single focus is we need to acknowledge higher for longer. My single focus is those residual Fed cuts that still seem to be the market is intent on pricing and heading into next January. Probably needs to get rid of them.
Yeah. We talked about the fog as being sort of a metaphor right now for a lot of the uncertainty that we have in the market. It's unfortunate and convenient. However, I do wonder how much this lack of conviction makes you have all that much more conviction in cash, because if you could just sit there and earn something, you know, even if you're not blowing it out of the water, it's better than nothing.
That's been the theme that we've observed in our flows for the best part of the last six months, if not longer. But having said that, there is one new dynamic seemingly coming through. Things are flatlined, so people are not adding to more cash because they're seeing that allocations are just so low right now to risk, and the institutional investors, you know, that we custody for, I think they're starting to push some funds in, not speculatively or opportunistically, but they're looking at valuations and they're looking at the growth environment. It could be a bit more benign than we give it credit for, so funds are actually being pushed back in.
In the next half hour, we're going to be speaking with Ed Giordani, who's going to talk about the mother of all melt-ups, MAMU, as he calls it. And I'm wondering how much this positioning right now of an increasing amount of cash is actually being a fuel for this mother of all melt-ups that could be coming?
I think it is going to be the fundamental asset allocation story for the second half of the year. But on top of that, the macro picture is, can we dare to envisage maybe a soft landing? Again, I was having a few conversations around this. If we can get to, say, year end with still payrolls around 200, 250,000, but core inflation, core PC on the way down to 4, 4.5%, I think that is a good environment. That's a good result. So if that translates into the corporate profitability, stability, and earnings growth as well, then with the cash on the sidelines, your better return profile, why not push cash back into equity?
I feel like right now there's two different views. Either you just sit in cash, take five, mm-hmm. or you go to AI and chase hopes and dreams. Right. Is there something in between right now for you?
It's that bubble story as well. If there's still one asset class I have conviction on globally, I think it's emerging market assets. A lot of interest in LATAM right now. They're benefiting from a US story is still positive. B, I do think a China stimulus is coming as well on the commodity side. And C, credibility in that region in terms of positive real rates. We always go back to the real rate story. The Fed is giving you a 1% or so real rate buffer, but in LATAM, they're giving you 2-3, if not higher. So in terms of asset allocation, the residual flow, I think a lot can go there too.
China stimulus, what are you expecting?
So if we use the benchmark from years ago where they had that tax cut round as around 2 trillion RMB mark, that is the baseline, the bare minimum to really make a difference to the data. But on top of that, I think there needs to be a shift in expectations. When I was there for the first time in many, many years a few months ago, there was just this palpable fear that things could still go back to where they were a few months ago. But that clearly is not the case right now. So there's got to be a governmental push, but again, encouraging the private sector that they can leverage, they can add to their balance sheets and move on accordingly. Because China's been de-risking, de-leveraging over the last 2 years.
To China, and it's, the last 24 hours has been just extraordinary. How do you treat the IMF's cautious five-year view, even what OEC did yesterday? Do you just instantly say, I want to be suspect of that and take a contrarian, more optimistic view on global GDP?
Well, I think global GDP is reflective of where global productivity is, where global demographics are. China's own growth forecast, if we go back to March, when they came out with the growth targets to the MPC, that was considered conservative at the time, especially if we take into account the rebound and the rebalancing coming through. But then if that is a warning signal, then I think it gives the impetus for governments to spend, to invest, to boost productivity, to boost growth and get things back on track.
Leland Miller at China Beige Book is heated that the street has this wrong. He's far more optimistic of the domestic Chinese experience and says it will even come over to a Pacific Rim statement. Is this the mother of all opportunities we're missing?
I wouldn't say it's the mother of all opportunities, but given the last 3 years, China's always been an afterthought in terms of asset allocation because of lockdown, because of other factors. Mm-hmm. There is an opportunity set there as well. But having said that, going to the fiscal story, that's also one thing I deeply worry about globally right now. When the IMF and with Chancellor Hunt upgraded ports for the UK, one thing Georgieva said was, please don't do additional fiscal stimulus right now. We've seen what happened in Turkey before the elections. We've seen what's happening in Poland right now. New Zealand, for example, pushing through stimulus. That's the last thing central banks need right now. To be honest, even the debt ceiling debate, maybe the fiscal consolidation, shall we say, was barely anything. So central banks, they need some help from the governments.
That was the most diplomatic way of saying they actually didn't make any progress in cutting any kind of spending whatsoever in the debt ceiling debate. Yeah. Just sort of putting this all together, this is a time of mid-year reviews.
Yes.
And there were a number of high conviction trades in the first half that were absolutely demolished, annihilated.
Right.
What are some of the conviction trades heading into the second half that you're concerned about? And I think about the conviction trades that you talked about of AI and long cash.
Right. So in terms of AI, do we want to think that is that you do have the growth story, you have the innovation story, but is there a Tina focus in there again? And I do have some cash allocations to push for. I will just go with the Tina theme. So I think that is one thing to bear in mind. But going back to my earlier point about Fed cuts need to be priced out, one conviction view that we have is this higher for longer narrative globally. And we're talking about potentially no cuts from major central banks at all until at least the second half of next year.
Wow.
Whereas, that is not something that's priced in, I would say, the Fed or anywhere globally, because it's sticky inflation. Persistent inflation and fiscal is only going to make that worse. And we've got quite a few elections coming up globally over the next 18 months as well. And we love electoral giveaways on the fiscal side, don't we? So that's where curve steepening, bond yields, will we even be looking at, say, JGB 10 years at 1.5%? These themes are going to come through.
Yeah. Hey, Jeff, that's interesting. Jeff, you there at BNY Mellon, looking forward to 18 months of politics and financial market volatility.
Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Join host Keith Lansford for this information-packed daily market recap, delivered in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcast. That's schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
On golf now, it would pay to talk to somebody that actually understands sport. John Garamendi is a Democrat from Sacramento, but far more than that, he's someone at Berkeley who was second-team All-American in football. He is someone that had a legit football prospect with the Dallas Cowboys and the Oakland Raiders. And he said, no, I'm going to go over to the Peace Corps with the love of my life to Ethiopia. And that was the end of his football career. He did so well in California politics, lieutenant governor, of course, insurance commissioner, and joins us here on the combat of modern sport. John, I can imagine the Saudis wanting to buy the Dallas Cowboys or something like it. Compare your analysis of this golf transaction, regulation, and monopoly with the shock if the Saudis or someone wanted to buy the Dallas Cowboys.
Well, actually, that kind of thing has happened in the soccer leagues of the world. The super wealthy, some of them from the Middle East, do own one of the key soccer teams in Europe. So, yes, it does happen. But this situation in golf is really unparalleled. What has happened is that the leagues, the PGA, LIV, and the European leagues have formed a monopoly, and they do not pay American taxes. So they can come into the United States, make billions, which certainly the PGA already has at least $1.5 billion annual revenue, and it considers itself a charity and does not pay corporate or any taxes at all. So we're going to end that piece of it. With regard to the monopoly, if I were a professional, wanted to be a professional golfer, I have no choice now but to bend my knee to this new monopoly. And if I wanted to sell golf clubs or I had a golf course, I've only got one choice. I'm going to have to take whatever they offer to me.
Gauge the bipartisan support. What's so different about Garamendi, folks, is he's been in the depths as insurance commissioner in California. Trust me, it's the worst job in California. So, John, explain to me how you're going to garner bipartisan support against the lobbying of the golf people, but frankly, the lobbying of football, basketball, hockey, and the rest.
Well, hockey, basketball, and the rest did have the same exemption. But over the years, beginning almost a decade and a half ago, those exemptions were eliminated, and they do pay taxes based on their net income. So there's only one left, and that's the PGA. It considers itself to be a charity, does not pay taxes on their income. They're exempt from corporate taxation. We're going to end that. I think we got a real good shot at it. Interestingly, in the 2017 Trump Republican tax cut, this tax exemption in the early drafts of that bill was there to be eliminated. A fellow whose initials were, JN, contacted the president or somebody in Congress and said, oh, no, you can't do away with the tax exemption. And it was removed in the final version of the 2017 tax bill. It's been floating around for a long while, elimination of this exemption. My staff, one of my my legislative staff guy, he wakes up in the middle of the night and tries to identify the worst, grossest tax loopholes. And this was on his list.
Yeah.
He pulled it out to yesterday and said, why don't we run with this and eliminate this gross tax loophole?
Congressman, there's a larger issue here as well when it comes to U.S. relations with the Middle East, with some of the areas that are trying to plow into a lot of the major sport that people really depend on, including golf. I'm wondering how much pushback you're getting from within your own party, especially at a time when Tony Blinken right now is meeting with over in Riyadh with MBS, trying to work out some peace deal. How much are people unwilling to really poke the bear in this particular instance?
Well, we ought to do more than poke the bear. It really, really angers me that we are forced to bend our knee to MBS, to Saudi Arabia, that has the worst human rights record perhaps in the world, and we know has assassinated and then hacked up a journalist who was critical of Saudi Arabia. We should never, ever put ourselves in the position of being subservient to anybody, and certainly not to Saudi Arabia. Now, just keep in mind, they've stuck the United States and really the world with an increase in petroleum prices just in the last week. They decided to cut their production, the result of which is America is going to wind up paying more for the gasoline and fuel that we consume. At the same time, this merger is going to give Saudi Arabia access to the American market, access to American money, and not have to pay taxes. That just really pisses me off.
Well, I just, again, I wonder, though, and to your point, how much you have support from other members of the Congress at a time when they don't want necessarily OPEC plus making another cut. They don't want a continuation of these cuts. They don't want oil prices to keep going up. How do they sort of gain leverage at a time where they might be equally angered as you, but might have these other interests as well?
Well, let's put it this way. If Saudi Arabia thinks it can come to America, run a business in America, and not pay taxes, something is seriously wrong with that equation. And that's exactly where the situation is today. And we as Americans ought to say, yeah, fine. If you like this merger, I do not, but if you like this merger, then go ahead. But by God, you're part of this system, and you're going to pay taxes. And that's that. You're not a charity by any stretch of the imagination. And this loophole, this gross tax loophole, simply has to end.
Congressman, 10 years ago or so, you decided that the nation had to honor a golfer named Jack Nicklaus. You put in legislation in the House. I'm not sure quite how it came out, but I want you to comment on a time past of Garamendi on Palmer, Nicklaus, and the sportsmanship that's out there. I saw that at Oak Hill at the PGA tournament of a couple weeks ago. It sounds like because of greed and money, we're blowing up what we knew. What can your shop on Capitol Hill do to get out front of this?
Well, there are two specific issues in play here. One is the tax loophole, which my legislation would close, and this new monopoly would then have to pay corporate taxes, as would any other corporation, and that raises a whole other question about American corporations that do not pay taxes, but we'll let that go for a while. The other issue is one of competition, and what has been created here is an international monopoly on professional golf. That raises very, very serious questions of competition or no competition. As I said at the outset here, if I wanted to be a professional golfer, I could have chosen to play golf in Europe or in the United States or in this new league. Now I have but one choice. I'm going to have to take whatever this new league offers me, and I have no negotiation opportunity. Similarly, if I have a golf course, I don't know, call it Bedminster, Trump's golf course, he could have gone and negotiated with two different leagues for the use of his golf course. Now he's going to take whatever they offer him. He has no choice. There's a monopoly issue here, and I would expect Congress to take that up. And if we don't, certainly the European Union should.
Congressman, thank you so much. The gentleman from Sacramento, the Democrat, John Garamendi. Subscribe to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live every weekday starting at 7 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app,
TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can watch us live on Bloomberg Television and always on the Bloomberg Terminal. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.